It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! Oh!
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
You have legs.
We have two more hours of this.
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want.
Welcome to episode 852. Of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, March 10th, 2024. I am the Solo Monster. I saw that Julia lost her New Japan Strong Women's Championship last night to Stephanie Vaquer at the Stardom show at Corken Hall. Julia's time with Stardom is coming to an end at the end of this month. She is expected to be part of Rossi Ogawa's new promotion, going to help get that off the ground. And then she's expected to be headed to WWE later in the year. I saw the clip from after the match where Vaquer had the title and Julia was trying to grab it away from her. I guess so they could do the spot where Julia presents it to her. But Vaquer was not having any of this. She was not letting go and was fighting her to hold on to the belt. Julia's trying to talk to her, probably telling her let go, but she won't let go. And then Vaquer whacks her with the belt. It looked terrible because she hesitated at first. And so it looked like a love tap. Julia went down and sold for it anyway. It was very funny to watch. Vaquer is like, no. This is my moment. I don't need you to put me over. There's also some sad news this morning to report from Japan. Yutaka Yoshi, who worked for all the major promotions in Japan over the years, New Japan Pro Wrestling, Pro Wrestling Noah, All Japan Pro Wrestling, he died this morning after a match. He wrestled at the All Japan show this morning, and when he got backstage, his condition was said to have suddenly deteriorated, and he was rushed to the hospital where he passed away. And a cause of death has not been revealed. He was 50 years old, and he was set to celebrate his 30th anniversary in wrestling later this year. Fans in the building said that there was no notable spot during the match where it looked like he may have suffered an injury. I'm looking at pictures of this guy. He was a big guy, probably around 350 pounds. You carry that much weight around when you're 50 years old. It could be any number of things. Doesn't have to be an injury. Hiroshi Tanahashi posted about it on Twitter. You know, he and Yoshi once held the IWGP Tag Team titles together. He's been a freelancer for many years, bounced around a lot of different promotions. So that's very sad. I was sorry to hear that. But we finally have some names, most of the names, maybe all but one, for this year's WWE Hall of Fame class. I'll be talking about who they are. Kevin Kelly is gone from AEW. I've got all the details and some thoughts on that. Sammy Guevara, meanwhile, he's not fired, not yet, but he is suspended. Okada has arrived in AEW, and he's going to be eaten well with the money that they are supposedly paying him. And a lot of people freaking out about this. We'll talk about that. And Dark Side of the Ring is back. The first episode covered the life and career of Earthquake, John Tenta. A lot of you seem to really enjoy my Dark Side reviews, so I think you'll enjoy this one too. But I want to say thank you to all of our PayPal producers here right up front. Thank you very much, everybody who sent a dono in. You can always do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal link at the top of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out, but you already knew that. Thank you to Big B, Bryant Becerra, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, the Portland Pop Star, Paul Hamilton, Road Warrior Roderick Welch, who is invested in this build to WrestleMania this year, Daredevil Doug Lippert, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eicher, the Gentleman Masher Shane Maniachi, Night Stalker Nayef Alsafar, Brian Man of the Hour Musha, thank you Brian, Killshot Keith Hart, Tough Guy Temjin Zephyr. Very glad you enjoyed my show with good mic work that we did on his channel. Go check that out. Stuart Bruiser Brody, who wants to send a shout out to his wonderful, fantastic, brilliant wife, Lindsay, who gave birth to their first child on Friday, Austin Stephen Walter Brody. This kid's got more names than Ed Leslie, but I love it. I love it. He says he's already got him listening to the Sound Off during his feeds. Another member of the Solomonster family. You'll love to see it. So congrats to you both. Nothing but good health for the little man. Mr. Pigeon Feather over here. I'm not even going to read this full name. Matt Scala. I am not reading that on my show. But I will give a shout out to your son. Charlie Up All Night. Charlie Matthew Scala. I hope he's doing well. Brandon, ring the damn bell. See, his name is Brandon Bell. We call him Brandon Ring the Damn Bell, because that's how we do things around here. By the way, I meant to tell Brandon, your YouTube link that you sent me for your song didn't work. So try tweeting it to me. But Brandon also started his wrestling training back in January. He's got an update on his training. He says, back bumps are a bitch. I'll bet. But nobody is touching me when it comes to promos. GWO for life. That's right. That's our GWO crew from the YouTube chats. Thank you, Brandon. Keep giving me those updates. And Dylan, too. Wherever Dylan is, Dylan's also in the middle of wrestling training. I'm telling you, this next generation of wrestlers coming up here. I'm gonna be the Dave Meltzer here of this next generation. I'm gonna have all the inside scoops here from all these wrestlers. Only I hope I do a better job than he has lately. I hope. Hey, listen, you can listen to this podcast on Spotify. You can drop a 5-star review. You can leave a comment under each episode. It does help the show. Don't forget, though, Google is shutting down its podcasts app at the beginning of April. I told you about this months ago. And I am reminding you again, you will no longer be able to listen to the Sound Off in Google Podcasts. They want to migrate people over to the YouTube Music app. And so you can listen there, or you can get the show on Apple Podcasts, you can get the show on Spotify, or directly through the Spreaker app, which would be my recommendation. It's free. A lot of people listen that way, so you got plenty of options. But Google Podcasts will not be one of those starting next month. And finally, don't forget, Becky Lynch has a brand new book coming out later on this month called Becky Lynch, The Man, Not Your Average Girl. Drops on March 26th. You can pre-order it now, though, the audiobook, and get it for free with our link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. 10 hours of audio narrated by Becky herself. If you're an Amazon Prime member, you can actually get 2 free books when you use the link. So go ahead and do so. audibletrial.com/Solomonster. We went from having no names announced for the WWE Hall of Fame a month out to having 4 names announced in the span of a week. And they are all very deserving of recognition. Triple H got his hands on the Hall of Fame this year, and he is making full use of that power. The first name announced on Monday was Paul Heyman, who is more than deserving of the honor. In the past, he has said he didn't want to go in yet because his career wasn't over, and he still had a lot left to do. But this being in Philadelphia this year, it's the right place to do it. This is a man who got his foot in the door as a photographer. He's making $50 working for Vince McMahon's father. There's a great photo of him posing with Lou Albano and Fred Blassie and the Grand Wizard backstage, probably at Madison Square Garden, when Heyman was only 15 years old. He was hustling even back then. And then he would go on to become a better manager than all 3 of them, in my opinion. In WCW, he led the Dangerous Alliance. He managed a whole bunch of legends before they were legends. Steve Austin, Rick Rude, Arn Anderson. He managed The Undertaker back when he was Mean Mark Callis. And then years later in WWE, they paired him with Brock Lesnar, and they became one of the best manager-wrestler duos of all time. I think it's either got to be Heyman and Lesnar or Bockwinkel and Heenan in the AWA. It's got to be one of those two. After Brock, he managed Big Show when he was the WWE champion. He managed Kurt Angle. He managed CM Punk. And now Roman Reigns. But before those guys, he got into promoting. And he transformed Eastern Championship Wrestling into Extreme Championship Wrestling, which was hugely influential on the 2 bigger companies, WWE and WCW. They would often copy from ECW. They signed a lot of ECW talent. The use of tables, right? Which the tables now are more over than a lot of the people on the roster. Okay, that was popularized, at least in this country, by ECW. Before Steve Austin was drinking beers on TV, the Sandman was doing it in ECW. Before WWE, you know, found its attitude and made all that money in the late 90s, ECW was all about attitude. If you don't think they didn't borrow from them and lift from them, you're out of your mind. They got on pay-per-view, just like the big players did. They got national TV, just like the big players did. They got their own video game, just like the big players did. They got all these things, but they just were not able to make enough money to stay alive. For all the things you could say about Paul Heyman, his creative mind, and that aspect of his career, Paul Heyman as a businessman, that didn't work out too well. The legacy, though, of that one independent promotion, it's amazing. It still lives on 30 years later. To this day, you still have ECW reunions going on practically every year. And if that's where his career would have ended, he would still be a slam dunk candidate for the Hall of Fame. But his career continued. It's almost like there's a first half and a second half of his career. And not only did it continue as a manager, or an advocate, or a wise man, or whatever he wants to call himself, but he did commentary. I mean, he did commentary in the early 90s too, but he did commentary again. He was the general manager on SmackDown. He was a writer for SmackDown during one of its greatest periods. And years later, Vince McMahon appointed him the executive director for Monday Night Raw. I think he did that for about a year before he got fired. Told him, you're doing a great job, and then he fired him anyway. But he kept him on as a talent. Because, you know, I know that if I think somebody is doing a great job, I fire them from that job. Because, of course, that makes sense. But I would say this man has filled every position there is to fill in wrestling except referee. But he was technically a referee because he counted the winning fall for RVD in his match with John Cena at One Night Stand. So technically he did that too. He's done it all. Heyman doesn't like to refer to himself as a manager. He used to call himself, when he was with Brock, he would call himself an advocate. And he's come up with all these different terms, advocate and wise man and special counsel, anything but manager. There's a reason why he does that. The reason he does that is because he once said that he can't be the greatest manager of all time. Because Bobby the Brain Heenan is already the greatest manager of all time. And he does not want to be the second best manager. But he could be the best advocate. And that's why he does it. And he's right. He's right about one thing. On the list of all-time best managers, Bobby Heenan is number one. And then I have Paul Heyman at number two and Jim Cornette at number three. Philadelphia being the birthplace of Extreme, it's only appropriate for him to go in this year. And I think he realized that, you know, it's Triple H's first year with full control over the Hall of Fame. And he was talking about this to TMZ the other day. Triple H now controls the Hall of Fame, wants him to go in. It's Philadelphia. It's the 40th WrestleMania. He saw the writing on the wall. He relented. He said, okay, I'll go in. But he's very adamant, like, he is nowhere close to being done. He said that he looks at this more as a Rookie of the Year award than a Lifetime Achievement award. Because he's just getting started. So he's made that very clear. As far as who inducts him, there's been a lot of questions about who's going to induct him, who's going to put him in the Hall of Fame. I like CM Punk for that spot. He's somebody that he managed, they worked together. Heyman was always an advocate for him, even behind the scenes when he was a lot younger. Heyman was an advocate for Punk when they started ECW as a brand in WWE. And it goes all the way back to that awful Extreme Elimination Chamber match they did at December to Dismember, which was the end. I mean, that was it. I mean, Heyman and Vince on the plane after that show had a big blow up, and that was it. Heyman was gone. He was fired, I don't remember if he was fired or he left, but he was gone after that for like 6 or 7 years. And a lot of it stemmed from the fact that ideas that he had for what he wanted to do with that ECW brand were not going to happen under Vince McMahon. He had his own vision. He wanted Bobby Lashley to be the ECW champion. Heyman wanted CM Punk to be the guy. He had all these ideas for CM Punk. So even back then, we're talking 2006. And maybe even before that, 2005, when he was in developmental, Heyman was advocating for CM Punk. So there's a relationship there and a respect there that goes back for a very long time. And Punk obviously has the gift of gab. You know, you put a live mic in front of CM Punk, he's very good at using it. So I think that he would give a great speech for Paul Heyman. I could also see it being someone like Steve Austin, who has his own ties to Paul Heyman in the past. Because WWE is probably going to want a big name for that spot. And I don't know that Heyman would even want an ECW guy to do the induction, because then it just becomes an ECW thing. They're already in Philly. Now I have to have an ECW guy. I have to have a Bully Ray or a Tommy Dreamer or an RVD do the induction. Tommy Dreamer already said he doesn't want to do it. He doesn't want to do it. He doesn't think he should be the one to do it. So I don't know that they want an ECW personality to be the one inducting him. His career was so much more than just ECW. And you know that Triple H is in charge now of the Hall of Fame, because not only is Heyman going in, but we are getting our first Joshi induction into the Hall of Fame. Per ESPN, Bull Nakano will be inducted this year. Now he needs to get the Jumping Bomb Angels in there next year. She started wrestling, she was only 15 years old, won her first title at the age of 17. And later on, she became the first ever CMLL Women's Champion. After that, she had a short run in WWE when they decided to revive their women's division. And as far as I can remember, we had like two or three wrestlers in the women's division. It was pretty much Bull Nakano and Alundra Blaze, and that's all I remember. I don't remember. I mean, I know later on they brought in Aja Kong later in 95, and there was a match on Raw. You know, Aja Kong, she did the spinning back fist, and my God, I mean, she broke the nose of her opponent. She was so stiff, she was a monster in there, and I think it was after that that Vince McMahon said, you know what, we're not doing this anymore. And that was the end of that. That was the end of the women's division. But Alundra Blaze, she absolutely should be the one to induct Bull Nakano. Bull Nakano beat Alundra to win the women's title before dropping it back to her months later. They had a match on Raw. And then she got arrested for cocaine possession, and that was the end of her WWE run. She ended up in WCW. She feuded with Alundra there, as Medusa. But they feuded again. Injuries led to her retirement in 1997. She was only 29 years old. And, you know, most of her success came before her time in WWE. And it feels like her career was very short when you consider the fact, oh my God, she wasn't even 30 years old when she retired. But you got to remember, you know, everything is relative here. She debuted at 15. Most people don't debut at 15. Rey Mysterio debuted when he was, I think, 13 or 14. Most people don't debut when they're that young. So she wrestled for almost 15 years. I wouldn't call that a short career. But she is regarded as one of the all-time great women's wrestlers, so that is a very deserving induction. And this year's tag team induction goes to Mike Rotunda and Barry Windham, the U.S. Express, who defended the tag team titles at the very first WrestleMania, which is why they're going in, plays into the 40 years of WrestleMania theme. For Windham, it's his second induction. He already went in once as a member of the Four Horsemen in 2012. I always figured if Rotunda went in as part of a tag team, it would be Money Incorporated with Ted DiBiase. He also worked as a producer for WWE for 13 years, until he got swept up in those mass COVID releases a few years ago. They lost the titles at the first WrestleMania to Nikolai Volkoff and the Iron Sheik, but they won them back from them a few months later. Then they dropped them to Greg Valentine and Brutus Beefcake. Windham walked out on the company, which pretty much screwed Rotunda over. But both men were eventually brought back. Rotunda did the IRS gimmick. Windham came back as the Widowmaker. If you don't remember this, if you don't know what the Widowmaker was, you are not alone. He did not last long with that. But they used to come out together for their entrance to Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA. Real American, though, which famously became the anthem for Hulk Hogan, and in my opinion remains the best song in wrestling history, was actually written for the US Express. That was not written for Hulk Hogan. But not long after the wrestling album came out in 85, Windham left the company. And the U.S. Express was no more. So they decided to give it to Hogan, because Hogan used to come out to Eye of the Tiger. But it worked out because they weren't going to be able to use actual music anymore. They had to get away from it. Hulk was their American hero now, and so he got Real American, and the rest is history. Rotunda is married to Wyndham's sister. That's where Bray Wyatt got the name Windham from his Uncle Barry. And you gotta wonder, with Bray's dad and uncle going into the Hall of Fame this year, they're saving a Bray Wyatt announcement for last. Fightful is saying The Rock has had input into this year's Hall of Fame class, and that his grandmother, Leah Maivia, is one of the names being considered for an induction. WWE is telling them, though, that The Rock does not have input into the Hall of Fame. So if The Rock's grandmother happens to go in this year, then I guess we'll have our answer. Vince McMahon sold a quarter of his remaining stock in TKO this week. That's over 5 million shares worth more than $400 million into his pocket. That would mean that he is now down to around 8% ownership of TKO. So bit by bit, they are shedding this. They're shedding this man like a virus. Mark Shapiro, the COO of Endeavor, was speaking at a Morgan Stanley conference this week, and he said TKO did not participate in the recent sale of his stock. He said TKO has not had any conversations with McMahon, nor do they know what his motives are in selling his stock. He said he doesn't work for the company, he doesn't come into the office, and he is not coming back to the company. And that is where we sit. It doesn't get any more direct than that. He is not coming back to the company. He also revealed that in their talks with Netflix about WWE rights, NXT was the original topic of discussion. So it could have been NXT and not Raw moving to Netflix, but in the end that did not happen. Now this week on SmackDown was a big segment with The Rock, Roman Reigns, Cody Rhodes, and Seth Rollins out there dressed as a little kid. Looked like he was dressing up as part of the Shield for Halloween with what he was wearing. They come out. We got all the long entrances, which is a staple of these segments. Roman Reigns now takes longer to get to the ring than The Undertaker does. The Rock is The Rock, so he's going to come out and soak up the reaction. He's got a pretty cool entrance now where they dim the lights and he's standing there and they use the LED screens and you see lightning bolt, actual lightning bolt effects in the arena. So I'm still holding out hope that when he walks out there at WrestleMania, it'll be to the old Hollywood Rock music, but I have a feeling that's not going to happen. So he comes out to the ring after Roman comes out to the ring and, you know, we got ourselves 15 minutes worth of entrances. And they positioned the segment to close the show. Now, in the past, over the last few weeks, we've seen them out there usually in the opening segment. Which is good, because that way, if they run long, they at least get their shit in. And they're not, you know, struggling to wrap up and they, you know, the segment ends and we don't get to see what they're going to do. Other stuff ends up being shortened. Other stuff on the show ends up being cut. In some cases. But they chose to close the show out with it because it was the main event segment this week. Cody came out through the crowd. Seth came out through the crowd. And they're going back and forth. And Rock is reiterating the challenge. It's going to be Rock and me, or Roman and me, against Cody and Seth. The walking clown emoji tag team match night one WrestleMania. And Cody, if you win, if your team wins, then the match on night two with you and Roman Reigns will be bloodline free. If, though, you lose, or when you lose and we win, it's bloodline rules, which means anything goes. Okay, this is what he mentioned the week before. Seth Rollins interrupted The Rock. He's been taking a lot of fire from Roman Reigns and The Rock, so he got serious. He interrupted him, told him to shut the hell up. He said they know the stakes. The future of the industry is on the line here. He said, listen up, Mr. Midlife Crisis. You had your time. You damn sure can't have ours. You want our answer? The biggest WrestleMania of all time? The biggest tag team match of all time? We accept. And The Rock said his piece. He made it clear to Cody. He said, if you do not complete this story, you will never, ever get another shot at this again. This being the WWE Championship. Didn't say that if you don't complete your story that you can never challenge again for the title so long as Roman Reigns is the champion. You will never again have a shot at this. And then he said, isn't it true you're the youngest of three? And your sister was a cheerleader for the Dallas Cowboys. Your brother is a Hall of Famer. Then he corrected himself and said, future Hall of Famer. I don't know if that was a slip of the tongue there. We'll see. But he said, you're 20 years younger than your siblings. You know why? Because you were a mistake. And all the other little mistakes in the crowd went, ooh. And Cody slapped The Rock in the face for that one. And it's a good thing he got the slap in when he did. Because they immediately went off the air within, I don't even know if it went 10 seconds more before they went off the air. It was great to see all four of them in the ring together. There's no doubt, you know, when they were out there, it felt exciting. You got all that star power in the ring. And you got 16,000 people in the crowd and they're reacting big to it. So it felt big. It felt like a big deal. And it is still surreal that we have The Rock back doing weekly television for the first time in 20 years. I don't remember if he was on TV this consistently when he was the champion in 2013. For those few months he had the belt after he beat Punk. I mean, maybe he was. I don't remember him being on TV this much. and he's going to be on television again this Friday in Memphis. But the majority of their time being eaten up by entrances and by ad breaks, it's just a killer when it barely leaves them enough time to get their dialogue in. You know, we couldn't see it on TV, but from the fan video in the arena, those production people were, they were whined and rocked down so much. They were trying to get his attention. They were waving at him. They were waving their arms so much, I thought they were going to fly away. Because they were running out of time. And they can't get an overrun on Fox. All the tweets I saw, why can't Fox just give them an overrun? They're not going to get an overrun on Fox because they have the local news in most markets. What do you think this is? This is not a baseball game. This is not a football game where if it goes long, we don't know how long the game is going to go. And so the news will be on whenever the game ends. It's a scripted television show. They have a format. They have their time cues. And if you know that you don't have the option of an overrun and you can't hit your cues, then you're doing something wrong. So either put these guys on Raw, where you have 3 hours, or put them on earlier in the show so that way you don't run out of time. Apparently in some markets they did run out of time and people didn't get to see Cody slapping the Rock. Now, you know, today you can just jump on Twitter, you can jump on YouTube, probably within 5 minutes of the show being over. And WWE themselves will upload the clip, or they'll upload the entire segment. You can watch what you missed. It's very different than how it used to be when they would run out of time, you know, on a Monday night and we had to wait an entire week, or we would just never get to see what happened at all. But even still, I mean, when Rock and Roman are out there, you know it's going to be 20 minutes of entrances. So they should plan for that. That just shouldn't happen. Cody didn't have a whole lot to say in that segment. It was really Seth Rollins who I thought stepped up this time. He needed to step up to The Rock for all the smack that Rock has been talking about him. And Rock, you know, he gave him the opportunity to talk back to him. I thought he hit him pretty good with that midlife crisis line. It was a hell of a lot better than Diarrhea Dwayne from Monday. So on night one of WrestleMania, it will be Cody Rhodes and Seth Rollins challenging Roman Reigns and The Rock. Cody and Roman will become the first two men to ever main event both nights of WrestleMania. And they took it one step further with Rock and Roman letting Cody know that this is his last chance. If he doesn't win this time, he will never again challenge for the title. Do I believe that? No. Of course he will. But I do think it telegraphs the outcome on night two. And they didn't need to do that. Now, is there a chance that Roman Reigns is actually going to win? Is there a chance that we might get a new member or two of the bloodline that's added and screws Cody over? Is it possible that Seth Rollins might turn heel on Cody? Yes, there's always a chance. All of these things are possible. I think there's a small chance, but there's always a chance. And I think that would be a terrible mistake. But I think most people figure Cody is winning. There's no need to make it more obvious than it already is. Now, to take it back to Monday, now that we have the main event of Night 1 all sorted out, there's another match at WrestleMania that has yet to be sorted out, but it will be after tomorrow night, and that is concerning the Intercontinental Championship. Adam Pearce on Monday announced that there is going to be a gauntlet match on Raw tomorrow night involving six men, three former Intercontinental Champions in Sami Zayn, Ricochet, and Shinsuke Nakamura, and three up-and-coming stars in Bronson Reed, JD McDonagh, and Chad Gable. And the winner of that gauntlet will go on to WrestleMania to challenge Gunther for the Intercontinental title. You look at the lineup there, you look at those six names, and it's either Sami Zayn or Chad Gable. Those are the only two men that have any sort of story involving Gunther or the Intercontinental title or the hope to become a champion, right? You look at all these promos. Sami Zayn did a couple of empty arena promos. He's been talking about wanting to do something historic. At WrestleMania, it's no longer about a world title. Now it's just about winning a championship. And then you have Chad Gable, who obviously has history with Gunther and has unfinished business with him. There's no story thread at all with any of the other men involved in this match. I know Ricochet, I think, lost the title to Gunther 600-something days ago, but it's not going to be Ricochet. It's not going to be, JD or Bronson or any of these people. It's going to be Sami Zayn or Chad Gable. I want very badly for it to be Chad Gable. But they dropped the ball with this. After he lost to Gunther in September and he saw his little girl bawling her eyes out in the front row, and Gunther told him to get to the back of the line. You're a terrible father. You had your shot. Get to the back of the line. That's where the next chapter of this story should have began. Instead of putting Gable on the back burner for the next 5 months, I mean, we saw more of Otis and Maxine and Tozawa on television than we did Chad Gable after that. Instead of putting him on the back burner for 5 months, they should have had him on television slowly working his way back into contention. I need to beat Gunther. I have to win. And every week, every week or every other week when he would wrestle every opponent, I can't lose. I have to win. And first, he's got to go through Shinsuke Nakamura. And after he does that, maybe it's Ivar. And then after that, it's Bronson Reed. Each win brings him one step closer, and Gable just keeps finding ways to win. Instead, they hid him away for a few months, and then they dusted him off when it was convenient, and now, if he can win one match tomorrow night, he's got his shot. It's a cheap way of doing things. And that's why you have people online, you know, some people saying, oh, Gable already got his shot and lost. Who cares? Like, what has he done? I don't want to see that again. Of course you don't want to see it again. They haven't given you a good reason to think that this time is going to be any different than last time. What has he done lately? Nothing. That's the point. You're right. All the men I just mentioned, the few times that Gable has had singles matches on TV since September, he's lost to every single one of them. Ivar, at least, he got his win back a month ago. But he lost to Ivar, he lost to Nakamura, he lost to Bronson Reed. Like, the storytelling has been very lazy. And I'm looking at this gauntlet tomorrow night. How do you work it? How do you do it? You know what I would do? I would start out with Ricochet and JD McDonagh. I would have JD McDonagh advance. Then in comes Chad Gable. Gable beats McDonagh. Then it's on to Nakamura. Gable gets by him. Then it's Bronson Reed. Somehow, he finds a way to win. Gets a flash pin or something, but he makes it past Bronson Reed, and then out comes Sami Zayn, who almost has pity on this man, because Sami's a good dude, right? He's like, are you okay? You're sure? The referee's checking on Gable. Can you continue? This gauntlet's been going on already for 35 minutes, 40 minutes. Yes, I can continue. I'm good to go. And the two of them shake hands, and they proceed to have a great match. It comes down to the two favorites, and you don't know who's going to win, because it can go either way. And you do one of two things. Either Gable pulls it out in the end, and he proves that he deserves that rematch with Gunther. And even Sami Zayn, as disappointed as he is, he gives him the endorsement, he raises his hand, go to WrestleMania, you get that gold, man. Right? You put him over in the strongest possible way. Either Gable wins, or Imperium gets involved at the very end for the double DQ. They ruin the entire gauntlet, which leads to Adam Pearce making the match a triple threat for WrestleMania with Gunther defending against Sami Zayn and Chad Gable. Now, I would rather it just be Gable and Gunther, but like with Kevin Owens on SmackDown, if he does not end up wrestling Logan Paul and Randy Orton for the US title at WrestleMania, I don't know where else you plug Kevin Owens in on that WrestleMania card. All I know is Sami has been the Intercontinental Champion before. Gable has not. And there's a better story to tell with Gunther and Sami next year when the world heavyweight title is on the line. I'm trying to look at the big picture here. Because I said a few months ago, boy, I'm looking forward to like WrestleMania 41. And by that point, Gunther's already the world heavyweight champion. He'll probably win it later this year. There's a story and a great match there with him and Sami, but it's not for the Intercontinental title. That's a world heavyweight title match. That's an entirely different story for Sami, where he's trying to win the one title he has not been able to win on the main roster. A top title. A world title. And no matter how good of a job Gunther has done this character, you know, to elevate this Intercontinental title, it's still not the top title on Raw. It's not the top title in the company. So I would save Gunther and Sami for next year. Right now, I want to see Chad Gable finally get that win. You've heard me calling for this now for months. Now we have a chance to actually see it. So I'm pulling for him tomorrow night. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. What I wouldn't give for an extra hour in my day. It would be an extra hour to get some work done, to get some sleep, or get some work done while I sleep. All right, so I guess that does, it doesn't work that way. But a lot of us wish that we had more time in our lives. You know, I woke up this morning and realized it's daylight savings time, and we lost an hour because you spring forward, you fall back. And I said, oh my God, of all the times I can ill afford to lose an hour, we have daylight savings to deal with. A lot of us wish that we had more time in our lives, but we don't. So how do you make use of that time that you do have? You need to know what's most important to you and make it a priority. Therapy can help you figure out what matters most to you so you can do more of it. Therapy can be helpful to you in a whole lot of different ways. It can teach you important coping skills. It can help you overcome certain insecurities that you may have about yourself. It can help you better understand your own feelings. And that's just a few. Therapy is not just for people who may have experienced a trauma of some sort in their lives, but it can help you there too if you have been through anything like that. So if you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's all online. It's designed to be convenient and fit into your schedule, regardless of how busy you may be. All you need to do to get started is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. And even better, you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. See, I told you it was convenient. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Solomonster today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Solomonster. Sting is officially retired, and he went out on top, undefeated as a champion and generating a $1 million gate last Sunday at the Greensboro Coliseum. Because you know his retirement match had a lot to do with that. He said that he considers that match against the Young Bucks to be among his three favorite matches of his entire career. Even Pat McAfee on Raw Monday night said that it was an epic match, and they had Michael Cole congratulate Sting on his retirement. Per Sports Illustrated, which I guess continues to live on after all, the only person not in favor of him winning his final match was Sting himself, who wanted to give the momentum to the Young Bucks. They wanted, you know, he wanted to put them over, but Tony Khan said no, and the Young Bucks said no. They all felt that Sting should go out as a winner. So in the end, the one thing that they ended up saying no to Sting about when it came to booking his retirement was the finish. And I'm glad they did because it was the right call. You know, sometimes you got to read the room. And that room, all 16,000 plus inside of it, would have been very disappointed if he went out on his back. Justin Barrasso also said the glass spot was all Darby Allin's idea. Of course it was. It was all Darby Allin's idea. He said that there was a plan B with a different finish in the event that he was not able to return to finish the match. There was a rehearsal earlier in the day. There was a stunt coordinator who instructed everybody on how to place the glass on top of the chairs. There was also at least one, if not multiple, doctors nearby that were anticipating the spot, and they were on high alert. You know, if you have to go through this is like putting a battle plan together for a fucking country going into war. If you have to put this whole giant plan together to the point you need a backup plan for a new finish, then don't do the spot. If it's that dangerous and it plays no role whatsoever in the actual finish of the match, then why the hell are you doing it in the first place? If it's so dangerous, you need extra doctors to be on standby. We need an ER unit on standby for this guy. I don't understand how Tony Khan doesn't say to him, you're not jumping from 12 feet up through a pane of glass and potentially throwing this man's final match into chaos. Just don't do it. I don't know why that's so hard. Somehow he only ended up with 12 stitches in his back. Conrad Thompson, on the podcast that he does with Tony Schiavone, said that Ric Flair wanted to turn on Sting one last time, and he tried to convince his son-in-law to advocate for the idea with Tony Khan. And Flair told him, look, you're friends with Tony, just go talk to him. He thought one final betrayal would be best for business. And Conrad told him, look, you're part of the storyline, you should go have a conversation with him yourself. And thankfully, Tony ignored him. I also learned something this week, that Sting's son, Garrett, the one who played Surfer Sting last Sunday, actually grinds Destiny on YouTube. He plays for hours on end. He was playing the other night. He was answering questions from people about his dad. So that's very cool. The jacket he wore, by the way, that was the actual ring jacket that Sting wore in Baltimore the night that he beat Flair to win his first world title at the Great American Bash. I'll say this about Sting. At an age where he could have very easily mailed it in, he went out there and he busted his ass. He took two table bumps. He put on a great show. And I'm very happy that he got to have what so many other top stars never had the chance to have. He got to book his retirement exactly the way that he wanted it. Exactly the opposite of how his retirement went down in 2015 when he got hurt. Right down to having his sons there with him, side by side. Imagine that feeling when he walked out on that stage and he had one son to the left as Surfer Sting and the other son to the right as Wolfpack Sting. Coming down to the ring with him. How cool is that? Hulk Hogan never got the final match that he wanted at WrestleMania because his back wouldn't allow it. Bret Hart never got the retirement that he wanted. He came back eventually. He had that awful match with Vince McMahon. That's not how I choose to remember him. Macho Man Randy Savage, Andre the Giant. You know, Bill Goldberg is still complaining that he never got the retirement match that Vince McMahon promised him. I'm glad that Sting got a proper send-off when so many others don't. Fightful reported that Sammy Guevara is currently suspended from AEW following his no disqualification match with Jeff Hardy at the Rampage taping back on Valentine's Day. So we're talking about something that happened a month ago. We only first learned about it this week. It wasn't an immediate thing because he wrestled Powerhouse Hobbs in another no disqualification match on Collision 10 days later. He got destroyed by Hobbs, and that was his write-off. We don't know how long he will be suspended for, and off television for. This is not his first suspension. He was suspended for 30 days 4 years ago after comments resurfaced from a podcast that he was on in 2016. Comments he made about Sasha Banks and what he would like to do to her. I'm not going to get into that again. He had to take sensitivity training for that. He apologized for that. Now they're going to be working for the same company. Maybe. With him, I don't know. It feels like this guy's on thin ice. You know, Sammy has been involved in at least two other incidents, two backstage incidents that we know of. One with Eddie Kingston, where Kingston, I think, pie-faced him, and then Eddie got suspended for 2 weeks. And then another one with Andrade, who sucker-punched him. There's a lot of people that don't like Sammy Guevara. He sucker-punched Sammy and still could not get fired. But Kevin Kelly got fired this week. Do you know how hard it is to get fired from this company? I'll get to Kevin Kelly in a minute. But in the match with Jeff Hardy, Sammy executed a shooting star press. And as he came down, his knee came straight down on Hardy's face. It was brutal. And Hardy suffered a broken nose. And there was a fear or belief that he may have been concussed. Anybody who watched that would think, okay, this guy is concussed. Now, they deemed that he was not concussed. After the match was over, they, I guess, did whatever testing on him, and they said, okay, he's not concussed. But at first, it looked like he may have been. In the moment, they did not know if he was or not. But you err on the side of caution. Now, the match was not immediately stopped. They did go right to the finish. The problem is that finish involved Sammy hitting Jeff with his GTH finish, which involves him kneeing his opponent in the head, which is not something you should be attempting with someone who you think might be concussed. As soon as he got the pin, you could tell Sammy was very upset over what had happened. It was an unfortunate accident. He didn't mean to do that. But because proper concussion protocol was not followed, Sammy got suspended. As far as we know, nobody else was suspended or penalized for what happened. That includes the referee, Paul Turner. That includes the doctor, Doc Samson. That includes Jeff Hardy himself. Only Sammy. Now you might be saying, why would Jeff be suspended? He was the one who got hurt. Well, that goes to what they were told, and Jeff Hardy was participating in the finish that followed, so yeah, there's always a chance that, you know, he could take some of the blame himself. But as far as we know, only Sammy was the one who was suspended. The way his knee slammed right down on Jeff's face, I mean, it looked awful. It looked like he was knocked into another dimension. Meltzer says that Sammy was told to go right to the finish. This is where I'm confused. And what he was told plays an important part in this. This is what we don't know. We don't know exactly what he was told. One version of the story is that Sammy was told to go to the finish and end the match. Another version, one that is sympathetic towards Sammy, is that there was a miscommunication between everybody involved. The issue here is not that he heard Jeff on the Shooting Star Press. That's not why he got suspended. The issue is what came after that. Now, John Moxley has talked before, and I mentioned this on the podcast when he did, about what he thinks the concussion protocol should be in professional wrestling, how he thinks concussions should be treated, or in the course of a match, if you think someone is concussed. And I happen to agree with him, where if there is this belief that somebody may be concussed in a match, you have a doctor and you have a wrestler watching backstage on headset who are in communication with each other in real time. Because there may be times where the wrestler can tell if someone is only selling or if it's part of the match. And they can communicate that to the doctor. The doctor is not going to be in the loop on spots that are planned and storylines and stuff, right? The doctor is there for one reason, to be on call in the event that somebody gets hurt. And then the doctor can come over and treat that person or make a determination as to whether or not the match should continue. That is the role of the doctor at ringside. The doctor is not part of the show. The doctor is not clued in about everything that is supposed to be happening in the match. But if you have a wrestler watching and they're on headset, they can communicate to the doctor and say, hey, it's part of the show. Or I think it's part of the show. Otherwise, if they think somebody is really hurt, you ring the bell and you stop the match right then and there. That's it. Full stop. You don't do your finish and then pin the guy. The match just ends. Now, that may not play well in the main event of a pay-per-view. I mean, imagine 5 minutes into the WrestleMania main event, it looks like Cody Rhodes may be concussed and the referee just calls the match off, right? But we're talking about people's health here. That's more important than any wrestling match. I think Moxley is bang on with that. We saw that recently, twice in WWE with ref stoppages. Remember when Giovanni Vinci, he got rocked by that Kofi Kingston dropkick in one of the New Day against Imperium matches. The referee called the match off immediately. And Vinci, I think he did end up being diagnosed with a concussion, but he walked off on his own power. Like, when he left, eventually, he looked fine. Everybody looked confused, but that's what you do in that situation. The match on SmackDown with Austin Theory and Carmelo Hayes when he went for that Spanish fly and took that terrible landing and almost broke his neck. Right? The match ended. That was it. The referee was right there. I think it was Ryan Tran. He was right there and he called the match off. Because that is what you are supposed to do. That's the way it should be done. I don't know what AEW's concussion protocol is, but it all boils down to, what did the referee tell Sammy Guevara? Where was the supposed miscommunication? This is on the referee and the doctor more than anything, because the minute it looks like somebody may be concussed, the match should be called off. Or you get the doctor over and then you can call the match off. You shouldn't even give the other wrestler the chance to go home and finish it. What is this, Mortal Kombat? Finish him. No, you ring the bell and you end the match. If you watch it back, Sammy didn't even know that he hurt Jeff at first. He couldn't see what happened. He didn't know that his knee landed on this man's that Jeff Hardy's face broke his fall. He didn't realize it. But the referee did. He was right there. He saw it. He immediately slid over to check on him. I mean, this really shouldn't be that hard. Now, where I could see there being a miscommunication is if the referee told Sammy to go to the finish or to go home. And Sammy took that to mean the planned finish, which was the GTH. There's a difference between go to the finish and cover him for the three count. Or roll him up and pin him. Right? Two very different commands. If he was told to cover him for the three count and he elected to do his finish anyway, then that's on Sammy Guevara and he should be suspended. But if that's not what he was told, they may have thought that Sammy would have enough sense not to do a move involving kneeing the person with a broken nose and a possible concussion in the head, but you need to communicate in clear terms what it is that you want that person to do in that situation. Yeah, again, all of this confusion could be avoided by simply taking the decision out of the talent's hands and ending the damn match. But without knowing exactly what the referee said to him, I can't say whether him being suspended was the right move or not. It was poor judgment either way, because I don't think you hit that move when you know something is wrong. The referee is telling you he's hurt, something is wrong. This is not the first time one of the Hardys nearly lost their life in a match with Sammy Guevara. All Out, 2020. one of the worst examples of malpractice that I've ever seen in a wrestling match, where Matt Hardy took a backstage bump off of a scissor lift down through a table. He had his brain scrambled when his head smacked the pavement. He was gone, okay? This man was gone. It was clear as day watching it on TV. I'm not even in the building with these people, okay? I'm sitting here watching it on television, and I can tell. His body went limp. Aubrey Edwards threw up the dreaded X, and they allowed the match to continue. Why? Because Matt Hardy wanted it to. He said, I'm fine. He wanted to continue. This guy had the wobbly legs when he tried to stand up. That should not be his fucking call to make. This is what Moxley is talking about. You can't leave that decision in the talent's hands because the talent is always going to want the match to continue. And if they are concussed, then they're not in the right frame of mind to make that judgment to begin with. I would hope that their policy is a lot better now than it was back in 2020. Because when Tony Khan talks about AEW being the safest place to work in wrestling, they have not demonstrated that in the past. That was 4 years ago. I sure hope their concussion protocol has been updated since then. But this is a great example of, even with a great concussion protocol, you still need people to actually enforce it. And that clearly did not happen here. I just don't know that we can say Sammy Guevara was the only one responsible for that. I don't know what this man has against the Hardys, but bad things seem to happen when they get together. I think they should keep them apart. In a story that has yet to be confirmed publicly, according to the Pro Wrestling Torch, Kevin Kelly, who was brought in to be the lead play-by-play voice for AEW Collision last summer, before being relegated to second string duty next to Tony Schiavone, has been fired from AEW. He was removed from the roster page this week, which got people talking, and then when Collision aired last night, he was not there. It was Tony Schiavone and Nigel McGuinness handling the announcing by themselves. It had been a three-man booth recently after they added Schiavone. According to The Torch and their sources, it was Kelly's post on social media last weekend that cost him his job. And for those who don't know, he went on Twitter and he accused Ring of Honor announcer Ian Riccaboni, the man who actually recommended him for the Collision job in the first place, accused Ian of libel and of sabotaging his career. I think his mistake was starting drama the weekend of Sting's retirement match. I think that's what did him in. This company has been filled with constant drama, and I think he picked the wrong weekend to cause drama, and that's why he's out of a job. On Twitter, he was replying to people and said, "When you go out of your way to intentionally mischaracterize my raising awareness of the global horrors of child trafficking to a fringe conspiracy theory that everyone knows is bullshit, in order to hurt my career and standing in the industry, that at the very least is libelous." Now he is talking about the movie The Sound of Freedom, which people say has QAnon ties. I'm not getting into the political aspect of this because I have no interest in getting into that. There are plenty of people working for AEW right now and WWE that share the same views that Kevin Kelly has if you follow his social media. What he is referring to is someone leaked screenshots of messages posted on a Discord server last summer by Ian Riccaboni criticizing Kevin Kelly. And Ian admitted to the Observer later on that the posts were his. But he didn't realize the posts were not private, and he claimed he didn't know how Discord worked, and he thought it was private, and ended up not being private. In the posts, he criticized Kevin Kelly's promotion of, quote, QAnon movies, that had he known he was going to be doing that, he might have made a different recommendation to management for the play-by-play position on Collision. And he said the QAnon stuff broke his heart to see, and he also said that Kelly blew the surprise of him being on Collision, which Ian was when Kelly was still wrapping up his commitments with New Japan. Ian filled in for him. So I guess he blew the surprise on social media, and I guess Kevin Kelly made a comment, according to him, about how nobody should wear a cowboy hat the same day it was announced that Ian would be filling in, and I think he was wearing a cowboy. In fact, I know he was wearing a cowboy hat on TV. I think that was when they were on their swing through Canada. So Kevin Kelly considers all of this to be libelous, and he thinks that it hurt his career. He was also tweeting his displeasure last weekend about how he has been used in AEW. He said, "But the idea of what I bring to the table is lost here because Ian libeled me. So I sit on the bench, valued by my peers, waiting to get my number called. Keep asking why, but get pushed aside. It's okay, because there is no one better than me. Ask the ones that know, and they will tell you. The Torch said that his performances were seen as subpar within AEW, including by Tony Khan, apparently, since Tony Schiavone was called to take over the lead role a few months ago. Tony Schiavone has talked about wanting to do more play-by-play. He talked about this a few months ago, and he went to Tony Khan a while back and told him this. And Schiavone figured that, if anything, he would get the play-by-play spot on Rampage. Then Tony gave him the spot on Collision instead. So yes, I think it's safe to assume that Tony Khan was less than enamored by the job that Kevin Kelly was doing. You know, it takes a lot to get fired by AEW. I was surprised to read that they fired him. This was not the Kevin Kelly that I thought was so great on those New Japan shows a few years ago. There was clearly a learning curve at first when he came in. His familiarity with the talent and the stories was not great when AEW first brought him in. I think when Ian filled in for him, people naturally compared the two of them, and Ian just did an objectively better job than he did. He was more familiar with the product. And I think they're both very good announcers, but clearly Ian had, you know, more of a familiarity with the product, and also just his performances were better. And again, you may chalk that up to Kevin Kelly not being completely up to speed at that point on the roster and the stories, but I thought Ian did a much better job, but he passed on the job to begin with. That's why he recommended Kevin Kelly for the spot, because Ian has another job. He has a shoot job during the week, and he wanted to spend his weekends with his family. He didn't want to be on the road doing wrestling commentary every Saturday. Otherwise, I think the job would have gone to him. So, you know, I didn't think Kevin Kelly was awful. I didn't think he was terrible. I didn't watch him on TV and think, God, this guy deserves to be fired. And frankly, I didn't see him getting the kind of heat that someone like Kevin Patrick was getting on Monday Night Raw. Kevin Patrick was being eviscerated on social media every single week because Kevin Patrick was not a good fit for that lead play-by-play role on Raw. I also didn't think the WWE was going to fire the guy. I figured they would find another role for him, you know, because he had done other stuff. He had done backstage stuff. He had done pre-show panel type stuff, and they just got rid of him altogether. But he was never a good fit for that spot. I didn't see people going off on Kevin Kelly the way that they were going off on Kevin Patrick or Adnan Virk or any of these other people that were, you know, tried out for the announce position on Raw. Him being fired surprised me, but him tweeting those things the same weekend as Sting's retirement, I really think that's ultimately what did him in. I think the timing had a lot to do with it. You know, there's a time and a place. And evidently, that was not the time nor the place for him to be saying those things. The Rainmaker is All Elite. Kazuchika Okada made his official AEW debut on Dynamite Wednesday night. He came out to seemingly save Eddie Kingston from a beatdown by the Young Bucks, but instead, he dropped him with a Rainmaker and became the newest member of the Elite, taking the place of Kenny Omega, who the Bucks fired from the Elite for failing to make his dates. Even though the man was near death from diverticulitis, we now have corporate heel Okada. Tokyo Sports, which often reports things in kayfabe, claimed that Okada's contract is for 3 years at an estimated $13.5 million, which would work out to $4.5 million per year. You know, Barry Bloom was representing him. He also represented the Young Bucks in their negotiations. Barry Bloom don't miss. I want him representing me the next time I have to negotiate my car insurance rate. Now look, in other sports, nobody would flinch at a number like that. In fact, they might think that number was severely low. For a professional wrestler, that is an astronomical number. And not necessarily one that I believed. Sean Ross Sapp on Fightful Select said that according to sources they spoke to in AEW and in Japan, the Tokyo Sports figures are accurate. Meanwhile, we got Dave Meltzer in this week's Observer saying the dollar amount is not accurate, that it's considerably lower than what's been reported, but it is still a lot of money. Maybe we need to cut the baby in half. Maybe they're both right, and it's actually $4.5 million total over 3 years, as opposed to $4.5 million per year, which would work out to about $1.5 million per year. But I think he was making a little over $2 million a year working for New Japan. So would he take less money to come over here? I don't know. But regardless, I don't care how much Tony Khan is paying the man. I'm just glad to see him on my TV because he is one of the greatest of all time. And I think that Tony Khan's primary objective was to do whatever it took to keep him away from Paul Levesque and to keep him away from WWE. And he was able to make it happen. There's no evidence that he ever even spoke to WWE. He considered them, but I don't know that there's any evidence or you know, solid reports that he actually conversed with them or that there was a formal offer presented to him by WWE. It's kind of like Will Ospreay. Tony got to him before he ever had a chance to even consider an offer from WWE. Plus, Okada and the Bucks, they have a friendship that goes back over 15 years. He has other friends there and people that he's worked with before. I would have liked to have seen what he could do under a Triple H-led WWE, completely free of Vince McMahon. But AEW feels like the right place for him to be. Plus, with their relationship with New Japan, it keeps the door open for him to still wrestle there if he wants to, maybe do a Wrestle Kingdom match again at some point. According to Fightful, he is believed to be moving to the United States and is going to be a full-time member of the roster. Not even Will Ospreay is moving to the United States because he didn't want to force his girlfriend, who's also a wrestler, and her son to have to relocate for him. So every time Will Ospreay appears on AEW television, he's going to be flying back and forth from the US to the UK. To go from the US to Japan back and forth every week would be a living hell. So it's not surprising that he would relocate, especially if they're paying him $4.5 million a year. If I'm Tony Khan, I'm not giving somebody $4.5 million a year to live overseas and only work a part-time schedule. If I'm paying you that much money, you're moving your ass to the United States. Now look, I don't feel passionately one way or the other about the dollar amount if it is true. Let's assume it's true. Let's say he's getting $4.5 million a year for 3 years. It's Tony Khan's money. Tony Khan is a billionaire, okay? His father is a billionaire. He comes from money. I'm not going to cry about a billionaire spending a few million on a wrestler. He knows what budget he has. He knows whether or not or when his company is going to be profitable. It could be that he is looking at Okada and Will Ospreay, for that matter, being key to a wider international expansion for AEW. And so he's willing to spend big now to make more later on those investments, right? They've got their annual Wembley Stadium show in London. Maybe he wants to break into other markets. Maybe he wants to run his own Tokyo Dome show or go into Australia like WWE just did. I don't know what his plans may be, and neither do you. Did he overspend for Okada? If he's paying $13 million for Okada and doesn't make that money back with him, then yes, he overspent. That's just simple economics. And if he does make that much money back, then he didn't. That doesn't concern me. I said the same thing when those reports came out about what Charlotte Flair was making, you know, becoming the highest paid woman in WWE. And that Mercedes was looking to make even more money than Charlotte, right? Those were the rumors at the time. I don't know if she is or she isn't. I haven't asked her. But if she is, good for her. Get that bag. She knows what she's worth, and if there's a promoter out there willing to give her what she wants, then I don't have a problem with it. My philosophy is make your money now while you can. When WWE was offering ridiculous money to teams like FTR to stay with the company, and to the Good Brothers to bring them back, are Anderson and Gallows worth the amount of money that is being reported that they paid for them? Not for the way they've been used, they're not. Now they're in NXT, probably making more than half the roster down there combined. And for what? They've done nothing with them. But they were throwing money around like they had a fucking money tree with unlimited resources. Because for a while there, they were doing everything to keep them away from AEW. They did not want these teams to be lost to the competition. So they were throwing money around to make sure they kept them. FTR ended up leaving anyway. Because they weren't happy there. I don't begrudge them for it. They got a sweet deal, Anderson and Gallows. They got a sweet deal and they took it just like most of you would. Especially if you're like Carl Anderson and you got six kids to feed. I still think a lot of these WWE stars, unless they are at the very top, are probably underpaid for all of the money that that company generates these days. Okay, I'll bet that if there was a breakdown of how much of that money that WWE makes, that they generate, is allotted to the Talon budget, it would be a small fraction of the money they make. It's probably even worse with the UFC. So you won't see me throwing a pity party if a bunch of millionaires or billionaires spend more than they should on a wrestler. Okay, this is another reason why competition is a great thing. Now, that being said, one thing that it does do, if those numbers are anywhere close to being true, now that they're public, one thing it does do is it opens Tony Khan up to having to spend more in the future to retain some of the names that he already has, who are going to go online and they're going to read about what Okada is allegedly making, and they may get hysterical about it. And they may say, wait a minute, if he's making that much money, I want that too, or I want something close to that too when my contract comes due. And then Tony has to decide whether Jericho is worth it or not. That's for Tony Khan to worry about. If he spends too much money signing all of this talent and he cannot generate enough money to cover those expenses, then AEW will have to start downsizing at some point and cutting costs. And then we'll know that he overspent. But until that time comes, I don't see why so many people are hot and bothered over this. Okada is a huge pickup. You hope that his star power can translate to the American audience. English is not his first language, but now he's got the Young Bucks to do the talking for him, which is one of the reasons I like him joining the Elite, although his English is actually not bad. I don't want to make it sound like he can't speak English. He can, but it's better for him to let the Bucks do most of the talking. He's not going to be out there cutting long promos on TV. When he first came up with the Rainmaker gimmick, he was a heel. It's not as if he hasn't played this role before. It's how it all started for him. And we saw some of that heelish attitude come out last year when he was bullying poor Kaito Kiyomiya. In one segment here, on Wednesday, they set up a Continental title match between Okada and Eddie Kingston, probably for their Dynasty pay-per-view next month. And they set up a future rematch between Omega and Okada. That should be the all-in match for Wembley Stadium. Omega Okada for the Continental Crown. Omega, on his new Twitch channel on Thursday, said that he recently underwent emergency treatment and that his recovery from diverticulitis has been 2 steps forward, 1.5 steps back. And he would love to say that he'll be back soon, but he can't say that. He was 24 hours away when this all started, when he was first rushed to the hospital from a blood infection and possibly dying. He still doesn't even know if he's going to need surgery or not. It's March. He's been out since December. And he still doesn't know if they need to cut him open or not. He could be back in 2 months. He could be back in a year. We just don't know. I hope he gets well soon. That is a match I would love to see take place at Wembley Stadium. One criticism I saw, though, about turning Okada heel is that AEW desperately needs babyfaces on top. They have more heels than they do babyfaces. Why are they turning Okada? So I went through the list of names, and on the babyface side, I count Will Ospreay, even though he is still hanging out with Don Callis. I don't expect that to last much longer, and frankly, even if it does, the people are treating him like a babyface. So you've got Will Ospreay, you've got Swerve Strickland, who after Dynamite this week is a full-on babyface now, Darby Allin, Eddie Kingston, Adam Copeland, Orange Cassidy, and you throw Chris Jericho in there too. I'll put him at the bottom of the list. That doesn't count Kenny Omega and MJF, who are out hurt, but when they get them back, those are two more names they can add to the list. Hangman Page and Brian Danielson, I have them on the tweener list because I don't know what you would consider them right now. If I had to put them, if you forced me to put Danielson in one column over the other, it would be the babyface one. Then you look at the heel side, you've got Samoa Joe, Okada, Christian Cage, Jay White, and Adam Cole, who is still months away from a comeback. And really, I mean, maybe you want to throw Wardlow in there, but I'm looking at, like, people that you would consider to be top heels in the company. So maybe throw Wardlow in there, too. That's it. Like, they're not overly lopsided one way or the other. Dynasty is already looking like a must-see show. We have a first-time-ever match that was made official on Collision last night between Will Ospreay and Brian Danielson. Samoa Joe likely will be defending the AEW World title against Swerve Strickland one-on-one. Okada should be challenging Eddie Kingston for the Continental title. Adam Copeland is challenging Christian Cage for the TNT title in an I Quit match, not at Dynasty, but they're doing the match on Dynamite from Toronto on March 20th. So they're not even waiting until the pay-per-view to do that. Collision last night, it felt like one of the more important episodes they've done in a very long time. Okada and the Bucks, they worked their first trios match together. I loved how the Bucks just let Okada do all the work. That drop kick he hit was just, I mean, chef's kiss. Just a thing of beauty. And then the Rainmaker put it away. 2 minutes flat. The perfect squash. Kingston tried to attack him. The Bucks took him down. Penta ran out. Okada dropped him. And then we got the return of Pac. We have not seen Pac in a very long time. Pac is back. And he and Okada went at it for a little bit until the Bucks pulled Okada out to safety and they announced a trios match for the Big Business episode of Dynamite from Boston this Wednesday. It's going to be Okada and the Young Bucks taking on Kingston, Penta, and Pac. Plus, Samoa Joe puts the AEW World title on the line against Wardlow. Switchblade Jay White takes on Darby Allin. In what could be Darby's final match, the way he was talking on Wednesday, it sounded like a suicide note. He leaves on March 27th to go climb Mount Everest, and he basically did a goodbye speech. Willow Nightingale wrestles Riho, who got a shock win over Chris Statlander on Wednesday. Willow says if she beats Riho, she wants a shot at the TBS title and Julia Hart. I wonder if they might have Statlander turn heel on Willow and maybe have this woman come to her aid, because we are getting the debut of Mercedes Moné, which has not been announced. They have not said a word about Mercedes, but it is the worst kept secret that she is going to make her debut on Wednesday. She did a podcast interview with the Kick Rocks Wrestling Podcast with Evan Mack. I thought I recognized that. I'm looking at that guy and I'm like, I know this guy from somewhere. He used to be on The Bump. I didn't even realize he left WWE, but apparently this was a few years ago he's been gone. So that's where I know him from. But she addressed why she walked out of WWE 2 years ago. She was very complimentary towards her former employer. She said that she felt she needed to stand up for herself. It was the hardest decision that she's ever had to make. She is very proud of herself for doing it and proud of Trinity for doing it. She's thankful for the career and the fans and the life that WWE has given her. And then she said, I know I'm going to be back there one day, so it's not over. She said, like I said, I have a lot of unfinished business and wrestling in a lot of places. I'm sure Tony Khan must be thrilled to hear his newest acquisition before she even debuts on TV talking about going back to WWE. Now, of course, she's going to eventually go back to WWE, but you don't say that out loud right before you debut for the other company. It's like the Kevin Kelly stuff I was talking about. Time and place. This was not the time nor the place. Oh, to be a fly on the wall in Tony's fridge when he reached in to grab another White Claw and he heard her say that. Look, I know the ratings did not reflect it this week, although the Okada segment got a nice quarter-hour bump. I think it was the second biggest thing on the entire show after the opener. But that show on Wednesday was excellent, and it felt to me like the reset they needed with Ospreay coming in, and he's already being treated like a top guy. Swerve is still very much in line to win that world title. Okada is in. Mercedes is on her way in. Hopefully they get some people back on TV soon, like MJF and Jamie Hayter. It felt like a more focused show. And I think if they can keep that same focus for all of their shows, hopefully it will lead to a bump for them numbers-wise. Also, it looks like the rankings may already be gone. Gee, I wonder who said that. I'm not 100% sure they're gone, since Samoa Joe and Tony Storm were still referencing them at the Revolution Scrum last weekend. But it's been a month. I didn't even realize it's been a month since they updated them. Tony Khan announced the return of the rankings on January 20th, and the first set was released at the beginning of last month. I gave it 6 months before they were shit-canned again, and I may have overshot the target on that. The minute I saw John Silver and Alex Reynolds listed as number one contenders for the tag team titles, they were already dead. But even before that, I told you, I said, they're not going to last. It does not work. It doesn't work when you have people doing open challenges and you have heel authority figures and the Young Bucks doing whatever they want. Like, that's fine if that's the angle you want to do, but that does not lend itself to having a ranking system like it's a real sport. It just doesn't work. It was never going to work. And I told you the week they were announced that it was never going to work. So let's see what happens. Let's see if they pop up soon. But considering the fact that it's been a month, it looks like rest in peace rankings. February 2024 to February 2024.
Hey, it's Chris Van Vliet, and when you're done with this episode of Solid Monster Sounds Off, check out some of the interviews on my podcast, Insight with Chris Van Vliet. Earlier this week, we had John Cena on the show for over an hour, and it's honestly my favorite interview that I've ever done. He went into detail about how close he was to turning heel in 2012 and exactly what that would have looked like. We're talking new music, new gear, a new attitude, the whole thing. He also dropped a big hint that he could win his 17th world championship. And on top of that, there's just a lot of John Cena wisdom in there. Also, check out some of the recent interviews with Chelsea Green, Roderick Strong, LA Knight, Bobby Roode, and a bunch of others. Check out Insight with Chris Van Vliet wherever you're listening to this pod right now.
Dark Side of the Ring returned this week in the Season 5 opener focused on the life and career of the late Earthquake, John Tenta. Not the kind of person you would expect to be featured in a series like this that so often focuses on addicts and abusers and some just really generally terrible people that have done terrible things, including murder. Earthquake was none of those things. He was described as a gentle giant. Nobody had a bad word to say about him, not only in the episode, but really anywhere that I've ever seen. He was a family man. He was a champion sumo wrestler, which a lot of people would never guess, you know, that this 380-pound Canadian would end up living in Japan as an undefeated sumo wrestler. But the notoriety that he achieved over there is what helped him get his foot in the door to pro wrestling, which he loved from the time he was 6 years old. Where the dark part of this episode comes in his final years, where he got sick. And he died far too young, not from any vices or bad habits that he had, but from an illness that, had he gone to the doctor sooner, he might still be alive today. He died 2 weeks shy of his 43rd birthday. So when he feuded on top with Hulk Hogan, think about this, he was 27 years old. I don't know what it was about some of these guys from the 80s. They look so much older than they actually were. Unless you're Virgil. He was actually older than anyone knew, but he looked younger. But then you get a guy like Arn Anderson, who looked like he probably came out of the womb looking middle-aged. So I don't get it. But Earthquake is one of those guys. I have fond memories of him because I came up as a fan not long before he debuted in WWE. So him wrestling Hulk Hogan and him squashing Jake Snake, you know, Damian, and making Quake Burgers out of him. Like, this is what I grew up on. I used to love playing as him in the WrestleFest arcade game, him and Mr. Perfect. In fact, I still play as him today now that I've got my little retro handheld device here. I've got WrestleFest loaded on there and I can play as Earthquake anytime I want. But he was also a mainstay on the old WrestleCrap message board forum for years before he passed away. And I used to love WrestleCrap and I always thought it was very cool that he didn't find it offensive, you know, when they had entries in there mocking his WCW gimmicks because, you know, even he would admit his gimmicks in WCW sucked. And so he took it in stride, and I always thought that's pretty damn cool, you know, that he would post there with all the regular folk. He would post in there, and he would do the occasional interview. The episode itself is very tame compared to other Dark Side of the Ring episodes, but it gets very heavy at the end. It was really, really rough watching the end of this. And it broke my heart to hear from his wife and kids about that final day that they had with him. So just be prepared for that if you are going to watch this. It doesn't seem like it would be a heavy episode, but it gets real heavy there at the end. Typhoon, his tag team partner in the Natural Disasters, was interviewed for this, as were Jake the Snake Roberts. They had Jerry Sags of the Nasty Boys. Haku was interviewed for this. Earl Hebner, who was one of the few people he would travel with when he was on the road, were Earl and Dave Hebner, and Jimmy Hart and Typhoon. Fumi Saito was interviewed. He's a wrestling historian and author. He was able to speak about Earthquake's time in Japan doing sumo, and Quake's family. His wife Josephine, his daughter Joanna, his son Jeff, and his youngest son John. As I do with all of my Dark Side reviews, I'm including a lot of my own information and my own research, since they leave a lot of stuff out of these episodes, given they only have 44 minutes to cover it all. He grew up in Canada. And even though he was from Canada, something they did not mention is that he got an athletic scholarship to LSU, and he played for the LSU Tigers football team. He played as a walk-on. The way the sumo stuff came about, in his own words, is they had the World's Fair in Vancouver. This was back in 86. And Japan wanted to put on a sumo exhibition, so they went to the local university. They were looking for a wrestler, you know, a Canadian wrestler to take part. And he was ready to do it. They ended up not having the exhibition, but the sumo master was impressed enough with him that he wanted him to go to Japan and do sumo. And so he moved to Japan and ended up being really good at it. I mean, he went undefeated, 24-0 in his matches, and he instantly became famous because he was the only white guy doing sumo. So he was an attraction. But he didn't like the lifestyle. It was hell on his knees and his ankles, and they wanted him to... At one point, I think the sumo master wanted him to laser off the giant tiger. It was like an LSU tiger. So he had this giant tiger tattoo on his arm, and they wanted him to get rid of it, which he refused to do. He would ask for time off to go visit his family back home, and the headmaster, again, or whoever, whatever they called him, would call him a baby, and it just wasn't working out. He wasn't happy. And because of how much of a name he had built up over there, though, he got the attention of the two major promotions, which were All Japan and New Japan. And he once said that he met with Giant Baba and Antonio Inoki separately, and he considered offers from both of them. He ultimately went with Baba and All Japan because there was just something in his opinion, in his view, there was something about Inoki that he didn't like. He found him to be a little shady. And it was only a couple of years after joining All Japan that he landed in WWE. I think he was in All Japan maybe for 2 years. And it didn't work out well there. He ended up in WWE. Baba just wasn't happy with him when they asked him to lose weight and improve his conditioning. He didn't do it. Things may not have worked out well there, but it was still the era of the big man in WWE, and they were looking for a big heel to program with Hogan. Could always use a new giant for Hogan to slay, and this all led to one of the more memorable debuts in WWE history. But before that, did you know that before he made his TV debut, and he was managed by Jimmy Hart, they tried out Slick as his manager for some dark matches? And he was dressed like a lumberjack. He wrestled in a flannel shirt, pants. The matches on the unreleased matches DVD that WWE put out a number of years ago. He even came out to Jive Soul Bro, which was hilarious. Imagine a trio of Earthquake, Big Boss Man, and Akeem. What would that total combined weight be? So that didn't work. I think he did that for one or two dark matches. So when it was time for his debut, it was a segment on Superstars. Dino Bravo had challenged the Ultimate Warrior to a push-up contest. And they would pick a random fan from the crowd to sit on their backs as they did push-ups, and the Warrior agreed. But it was a trap. They called this giant man out of the stands, and he sat on Bravo's back, no problem. When it was time for him to sit on Warrior's back, he sat down on his back all right, and then he splashed him, and they left him laying. And the Canadian Earthquake was born. Eventually, they dropped the Canadian part, and he just became Earthquake. But for a few months there, he was the Canadian Earthquake. So he got to work Hogan in a top program not long after that. That was in 1990. Hogan had dropped the title to the Ultimate Warrior at WrestleMania. He was going to go off to film the movie Suburban Commando. And so they worked an injury angle on the Brother Love Show, where Earthquake squashed him, and he had to be carted out. And according to Bruce Pritchard on one of his older podcasts, the reason they came up with the letter writing campaign, where fans could send get well messages to Hogan in the hospital, because that was this whole campaign, you know, the Hulkster, he wants to hear from his Hulkamaniacs, and so write to this address. The reason they did that whole campaign, it was designed to grab the return addresses for the fans who sent letters, so they could take them and add them to their mailing list for their merchandise catalogs. So, smart. Deceitful, but smart. Hogan was back by the summer. They wrestled at SummerSlam. That's one of only three singles matches that Hulk Hogan ever had at SummerSlam, which is hard to believe, but it's true. The other two, Shawn Michaels in 2005 and Randy Orton in 2006, which ended up being his final match ever in WWE. And Hogan beat Earthquake by countout on that SummerSlam show in 90 because they wanted to protect him so they could work a house show program together, keep things going. Hogan liked working with him, and they did big business together. They covered the infamous match in Japan with Koji Kitao. There was a joint show that WWE did with the SWS promotion. I think Tenryu might have run the promotion. And it's very rare that you would see Vince McMahon's WWF co-promoting or working a joint show like this with another promotion. In fact, this may have been the last time they did that. But this would have been just after WrestleMania 7. So this was the year after. And some background first on Kitao that they did not get into here in this episode. WWE brought Kitao in with Tenryu for a tag team match to wrestle Demolition at WrestleMania. This was part of the partnership between the two promotions. Two Japanese wrestlers that the WWE audience could not pick out of a lineup. They come in and they squash Demolition in under 5 minutes. In what ends up being Demolition's final match. It was Smash and Crush, not Axe and Smash. I mean, Demolition was a shell of itself by this point. They even got rid of their great theme song. They stripped it down to bare bones. I think once Vince McMahon got his hands on the Road Warriors, it was a combination of two things, really. Him getting the Road Warriors under contract and Axe's health. Because he had some issues with his heart. He wasn't able to wrestle for a while. I think it was an allergic reaction that he had to some shellfish, and it triggered some kind of heart issue. But I think that's what necessitated their bringing in Crush as the third member of Demolition. But by that point, it was pretty obvious. I mean, he had lost all interest in them, and it's a sin the way their run came to an end. But anyway, Kitao was a big deal in Japan. Like Earthquake, he was a legit sumo wrestler. And he was the biggest name sumo who was still, I guess you would say, in his prime to ever join pro wrestling. So over there, he was a celebrity. Now, he wasn't very well liked. You know, the reason his sumo career came to an end was because the guy was a jerk. And he threw a tantrum once where he kicked his 88-year-old stable master and he shoved the man's wife into a sliding glass door. Okay, so the dude was an asshole. And he wasn't very happy about doing the job back-to-back shows for Earthquake. They actually had two matches. The first one went fine. Kitao did the job. That was at the Tokyo Dome. And I think it was two nights later. Second match, that's where things went haywire. And the one that they showed here in this episode. Haku, I said he was interviewed for this show. He noted that Kitao thought that he was Bruce Lee or something. From the moment the match started, and it's on YouTube, so you can watch the whole thing. It's actually very boring. From the moment the match started, Kitao went into business for himself. He refused to cooperate with Tenta. Okay, it was boring to watch because they mostly just stood there. They barely even touched each other. Kitao did a gesture with his hand like he was going to gouge Tenta's eye out, and you could see Tenta, he's getting pissed off after a few minutes, and he sees this, and he's mouthing the words like, this is wrestling, this is pro wrestling, like, what are you doing here? Like, he was not happy about this, and Kitao ends up throwing a shoot kick at the referee, which got him disqualified. He left the ring, he's throwing a table around, he grabs the house microphone, and he starts ranting, you know, in Japanese, that Tenta is a fake, wrestling is fake, and I'm not going to lose to him again. A few days later, Kitao gets fired, and off he went into the dustbin of history. He passed away a few years ago, right before the pandemic. Then came Earthquake's feud with Jake the Snake Roberts. And, you know, Jake, he had a few memorable angles that were a part of my childhood. The angle with Earthquake, the snakebite incident with Randy Savage that came later that same year, and the funeral parlor segment where he slammed the lid of the casket on Undertaker's hand, that image of Undertaker dragging the casket behind him with his hand still trapped inside, chasing after Jake. I mean, he moved like a zombie. But those are some of the more memorable angles from that time. The idea here was that Earthquake would send Jake out of the ring, and then in the ring, he would take the bag that Jake would always bring to the ring with him that had the snake inside, and he would put the bag in the middle of the ring, and he would do his sit-down splash on the snake. He was going to kill Damien. Jake, in the episode, he said that he told, I don't know if it was Vince or Pat Patterson or whoever it was who was booking the angle, he said, no, you're doing it all right. And this is where Jake's mind for these things, you could really see the gears going here. He goes, no. He goes, you don't want to throw me out of the ring so I don't see it. What you want to do is you want to have him tie me up in the ropes and force me to watch. And he's right. That was the more impactful way to do it. And so that's what they did. They had Jake all tied up in the ropes. And he was crying and he's just begging him, don't do it. And, you know, Earthquake comes off the ropes and he squashes the snake. And I can remember two versions of this. I know that they showed it this way, uncensored on TV. And then on one of the syndicated shows, when they recapped the angle on the Event Center with Sean Mooney, I remember they put, I don't know if they put a giant X on the screen or they cut away. I think they cut away at the very last second. I think the giant X was the snakebite angle that I'm thinking of. But he squashes the snake. Now, obviously, the snake was not in the bag, as Earthquake would reveal many years later. It was pantyhose filled with hamburger meat. I'm sure that must have felt very squishy. So they got some heat for the angle from some of the animal rights groups, but obviously they did not actually kill the snake. So they also had footage from Primetime Wrestling and the Quake Burgers angle that came after this, where we see Earthquake, they're in studio, and he's in his chef hat, and he's serving a tray of hamburgers to Vince McMahon and Bobby the Brain Heenan before they eventually figure out what they're supposedly eating is Damien. And Vince, when he realizes it, he gets really angry, he cusses, and he knocks the tray over, the burgers go flying, he's so disgusted, he walks off, Bobby Heenan is like retching. Meanwhile, Quake is just standing there. He's still chowing down. He's enjoying himself. So just remember, before the big boss man fed Al Snow's own dog to him on TV, we had Earthquake feeding Jake Snake to Vince McMahon and Bobby Heenan. I don't remember them having a match on TV. I think they just worked a house show program out of it. That was the case with a lot of these things back then. You know, when I remember some of these angles they shot on WWF television and some of the syndicated shows. I remember Undertaker and the Berserker. They did this whole angle on television once where the Berserker tried to murder him with his sword. He went to go literally plunge the sword down into this man's chest, and the Undertaker rose up at the last second and the sword went right through the canvas. I can't remember a single match that I ever saw between the Undertaker and the Berserker, but I remember that angle. But I'm sure they must have worked a house show program together. That's just the way it was. Ric Flair and Roddy Piper. Same thing, right? They feuded a little bit on WWF television. Did they ever wrestle one-on-one on TV or on a pay-per-view? No. They worked plenty of matches together, just didn't air on television. And so when that was over is when they paired up Earthquake with Tugboat, who they repackaged as Typhoon. We had Earthquake and we had Typhoon. And they became the Natural Disasters. And that's where we get to see Fred Ottman in the episode. Uncle Fred! It's Cody's Uncle Fred. They glossed over Tugboat's entrance into the company. He was brought in as Hulk Hogan's friend. It's too bad they couldn't get Bruce Pritchard for this to tell the story of how we almost got Sheik Tugboat, the Iraqi sympathizer, against Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 7. Yes, that is a real thing that was considered. Before they settled on Sergeant Slaughter, Vince McMahon talked about going with Tugboat as Sheik Tugboat, or whatever new name they would have come up with for him. It probably would not have been Sheik Tugboat, which is fucking hilarious, but it would have been some other name they would have come up with for him. From the Sheik Master to the Shock Master, that would have been quite the transition. So they ended up going babyface not long after, because they started out as heels, but they went babyface after a while. And they won the tag team titles. The way it all came about, though, would have been interesting for them to get into, which they did not. They were feuding with the Legion of Doom at the time. And Hawk failed a drug test, and he got suspended. So they had to get the belts off of them very quickly. And they dropped him to Ted DiBiase and IRS at a house show. DiBiase and IRS, they were put together as a makeshift tag team. I don't remember if they were even together on TV before they got the belts. They may have been rushed together just to get the belts on someone else. And all of a sudden, we had Money Incorporated. And I know that there was supposedly talk of Shawn Michaels and DiBiase being put together as a tag team after Shawn went heel and the Rockers split up. Michaels and DiBiase both had Sensational Sherry as a manager, so I could see there being some truth to that, maybe. DiBiase was asked about this on his podcast a while back. He knew nothing about it. So if it was discussed, no one told him about it. It may have just been something that was talked about in the Observer and the Torch at the time. But they settled on DiBiase at IRS, and they feuded them with the Natural Disasters, who eventually won the belts from them at a house show. I don't think I've ever seen footage, because I don't think it's ever been released, of the title change. I know when Money Incorporated won the belts back, that did air on TV. That aired on Wrestling Challenge. But I cannot remember ever seeing video of Quake and Typhoon actually winning the tag team titles. And it's amazing how many times, if you look back, in 92 and 93 especially, those tag team belts, how many times they changed hands at house shows. You know, Money Inc. won them from LOD at a house show. The Natural Disasters won them at a house show. There were multiple times the title swapped in 93, back and forth at house shows between Money Inc. and the Steiner Brothers. And so the family, in the episode here, they talked about how much John was on the road. His kids didn't get to see a lot of him. Jake took a shot at Vince McMahon for the inhumane schedule that they were running back then. Look, it was a ridiculous schedule, absolutely. But back then, they paid these guys only if they worked. They didn't have guaranteed contracts. Unless you were someone like Hogan, you didn't get guaranteed money. So had they scaled back on the schedule and ran fewer shows, these guys would have been paid less, and they would still be blaming Vince McMahon. Not that there aren't valid reasons to blame Vince McMahon for a lot of things, but they would just complain about not being paid as much if he had done that, because there would have been less money coming in. So Earthquake ended up going back to Japan in 93. Typhoon stayed behind until his brother-in-law was shot. He was running a bar. It was an incident that happened outside the bar. He was trying to break up a confrontation. He got shot and killed on the spot. And so Typhoon had to get off the road. He had to go take care of his family, and I think he may have taken over the business. And then came the Shockmaster. From the mind of the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes. The man who is credited with a lot of great ideas and having a great mind for the business, and war games, and all of these things. It just goes to show you that nobody is perfect. I kind of feel like Earthquake getting this episode here may have had more to do with being able to get Fred Ottman on to talk about the Shockmaster than anything else. Like, this was the one excuse they had to cover this, because it went from being about John Tenta to suddenly being about Fred Ottman and the Shockmaster. Earthquake had nothing to do with any of this. But by this point, since they covered it, we may as well get into the weeds here. Ric Flair had come back to WCW, right? He's not allowed to wrestle for a certain period of time. He can't get back in the ring right away. I guess that was part of his agreement with Vince McMahon allowing him out of his contract. And so they gave him a talk show, and he called it A Flair for the Gold. And on this installment of A Flair for the Gold, this was airing live, okay? This may have been a Clash of the Champions special. Whatever it was, this was live television. Sting and the British Bulldog were going to reveal their mystery partner for a match against Sid Vicious and Harlem Heat. They brought Ottman into the company to play the Shockmaster. And the whole point of it was, he was basically going to be like a superhero character. He was wearing a stormtrooper helmet that somebody covered in glitter. Took them hours to cover this thing in glitter. What he wore in the segment was not even the original outfit. That was just meant to be his sort of walkout costume for his first appearance. That's not what he would have wrestled in. It was going to be blue with gold lightning bolts going down the legs. I think he said before that he still has the costume at home, so it was already made. And he would have worn like a lucha-style mask with lightning, with one lightning bolt going through the face and the top where his hair would come out. So they already had all this stuff designed. And the problem is, all the glitter was coming into his eyes, through the eye holes. And so what they did was, they got a pair of pantyhose from one of the secretaries who worked there. They cut two pieces out of it, and they glued them to the eye holes so that he wouldn't be blinded by the glitter. So we were already off to a great start here. So now, they rehearsed this beforehand. But someone, I guess, is a support beam for the wall that they built. And it was like a very thin layer of sheetrock. You know, they built this wall, and the whole point was he was going to smash through the wall like the Kool-Aid Man, and he was going to come out during this segment when they announced their partner as the Shockmaster. Well, the problem is they put a 2x4 down I don't know if it was on the floor or a little bit above the floor, right by where he was supposed to bust through the wall. Well, he didn't see it because he had this fucking helmet on his head. So when he busted through, not only did he faceplant on the floor on live television, but the helmet flew off his head. It looked like he decapitated himself, and his head was rolling across the floor. That's where the story comes from that Dusty Rhodes tells about Cody watching this at home. Cody was a little boy at the time. He's watching it at home on TV, and the helmet comes off, and he looks up and he says, "That looks like Uncle Fred," because it was. It was Uncle Fred, and they showed the video. Now, I'm laughing about this, but they showed the video to Haku for the first time. He had never seen this before, and they showed it to him, and I have never seen that man laugh so hard in my entire life. It's actually, I think it's great medicine for the soul, watching Haku lose his shit over the Shockmaster. Like, if you see nothing else, I know they put the clip up, I think, on their the Dark Side of the Ring Twitter page last week. Just watch that. Like, it is hilarious. We get back to Earthquake now. Now that we got the Shockmaster out of our system. Earthquake comes back to WWE for a very short run in 94. That's where he had the sumo match on Raw with Yokozuna. He wasn't happy financially with what he was being paid. And so as quickly as he returned, he was gone again. And Hogan is the one who lobbied for him to get a job with WCW. He got more money. He had fewer dates. Hogan, of course, is always looking for big guys that he can beat. So he got him a job with WCW. And he got to be home more with his family, so it was a good deal for him. Now, when he came in, he couldn't be Earthquake because he didn't own the copyright on that. Or trademark, I guess. So he ended up with a few different gimmicks. First, they called him Avalanche, which was technically a natural disaster, and so he wasn't allowed to use that. I think he was using that name for like a year, but at some point, all of a sudden, he's not allowed to use it. It's kind of like when the Big Boss Man left WWF, and he went to WCW, and they called him The Boss. And he was The Boss for a while, until WWF said, no, you can't be The Boss. And so then he was the Guardian Angel, and he was Big Bubba Rogers again. He went through a few gimmicks also. So now he can't be Avalanche anymore. And so he became The Shark. And then eventually he just started going by John Tenta. And they had footage of the infamous interview on Nitro where he comes out and he tells Mean Gene, he goes, I shouldn't laugh. They saddled this poor guy with this stupid gimmick. But he comes out, Gene is like, well, Shark. And he stops him in mid-sentence. He goes, hold on a second. He goes, I'm not a shark. I'm not a fish. I'm a man. I'm John Tenta. But he made it very clear, I am not a fish. I'm glad he cleared that up. So he ends up coming back to WWE, because he wasn't in WCW for that much longer after that. He ends up coming back to WWE during the Attitude Era, as part of the Oddities. He comes in as Golga. So he was in a mask, he never cut promos, he walked around everywhere with this plush doll of Eric Cartman from South Park. Jake in the episode said that it was meant to humiliate him. I don't think that was the case at all. I'll tell you what, the Oddities were over in the Attitude Era. Okay, they were the freak show group, but they were over with those crowds. And I say that as someone who was in some of those crowds. Everybody loved to wave their arms around when the Oddities came out with that music, the ICP music. Say what you want to, but that was an overact at that time. Now, he had slimmed down a little bit. He was around 380, I think he had said once at that point. I mean, so still a very big guy. I mean, he's 380 pounds, but he didn't look like the Earthquake of old. So it may have just been a case where they felt like, you know what, you're not big enough to be Earthquake anymore, so we'll find something else for you to do. After that ran its course, he opened up a wrestling school. Then he got the call to do the gimmick Battle Royal at WrestleMania X7, where he got to play Earthquake on TV one last time. I know he had a dark match at a SmackDown taping later that year in 2001. He got a pretty good reaction, too, if you watch it back, but nothing ever came out of it. And honestly, you know, at that point in WWF, I mean, late 2001, it's almost 02 at that point, he felt out of place, you know, looking at him in that gimmick and everything. Could they have found a role for him? Sure. But you could tell, like, it was just a different time in the company. And it was tough to envision what role they could have found for him on TV that he would have been happy with. Because one thing that he's been very clear about in any interview I ever saw of him is that he was very impatient and he wanted to work. He wanted to be involved in something. He didn't want to just be kind of on the back burner or anything. And there were a few times over his career where he left. You know, he left certain promotions because of that. He wasn't happy. They weren't doing anything with him. I don't know what they would have had for him at that time that would have satisfied him or made him happy. The school he had eventually shut down. The family went into bankruptcy. So he took a job working in retail at a department store in the mall in the big and tall section. And it's sad that this man who used to wrestle on national television for multiple promotions, and he attained a pretty decent level of fame doing it, had to work in retail just to make ends meet. But he did what he had to do to support his family. You know, there's no shame in that. It's just sad that he even had to do it in the first place. You know, to go from working main events against Hulk Hogan to working at the mall is quite a different situation. Earl Hebner said that, you know, John would have shoveled shit if it meant making money for his family. The retail thing didn't last. He ended up working as a truck driver, which meant extended time on the road. And when you're making those long road trips, you know, you keep that bottle or you keep that jug with you in the truck so that you can pee into it when you have to, so you don't have to constantly stop on the side of the road and get out of the truck. He started noticing blood clots in his urine, but he was on the road all the time. He didn't think it was all that serious, so he kept it quiet from everyone and he didn't say anything. Eventually, he went to the doctor, and by that point, he had waited too long. They found a tumor in his bladder, and the cancer had already spread. And he had a form of cancer, he had bladder cancer, that was very curable. And if only he had gone to the doctor sooner, it's very likely that he would still be alive today. His son said that if his dad was still wrestling, they may have caught the cancer earlier. And we went from seeing Haku crying tears of laughter to crying tears of sorrow as he talked about wishing that John would have told him that he needed help. I mean, this was heartbreaking to watch. By 2005, things were looking positive. He had high hopes the treatment was working and he could beat it. His son Jeff was about to get married, and that's when Quake got the news that the cancer was no longer responding well at all to the treatment, and it had actually grown and it had spread to other parts of his body, including his lungs. And he and his wife decided not to tell the kids at first. At the wedding, his wife started singing karaoke and just broke down crying. Because she knew. And the kids didn't know, but she did. By that point, they knew the end was near. And they had a reenactment. Because, you know, they do the reenactment scenes here on Dark Side of the Ring. They had a reenactment of the entire family standing around John on his deathbed. And one by one, they each said, you know, what they wanted to say to him. Each of the kids got to go up to him and say their goodbyes. There wasn't a dry eye in this room watching this, I'll tell you that. And he was holding his daughter's hand at the exact moment that he passed away. He was 2 weeks shy of his 43rd birthday, only a few months shy of the birth of his first grandchild, and he passed away. No wrestler showed up to his funeral. They mentioned that during the special, which it seems to be a recurring theme with a lot of these wrestlers. And, you know, on the one hand, I understand that they're co-workers, okay? So in a lot of cases, we can look at it and go, oh my God, how come everybody didn't show up? This person died and that person died and so on and so on. Mean Gene, like barely anybody showed up to Gene Okerlund's funeral, and Sensational Sherry. Like, we hear so many stories like this. And yes, they're coworkers, but you also do make friends in this business, and you're tight with certain people. And so the idea that these people pass away and nobody from the wrestling industry shows up. Yeah, you dedicate your entire life. You can have a 15, 20, 25, 30-year career, and the idea that nobody shows up is just crazy to me. But evidently, nobody showed up to the funeral. And Josephine, his widow, said that John was her soulmate. His son says that his dad was many things to many people, but to them, he was a great dad. I'm really glad they chose Tenta as a topic, even though he doesn't fit the usual profile of one of these episodes. There wasn't anything salacious or controversial or slimy about him. He was a good man who was dealt a very bad hand and who happened to find fame and success in the wrestling business. But I think people would find his backstory, you know, getting into wrestling very interesting with the sumo stuff. and some of the footage and the photos that they showed during the episode, because it isn't something that you would expect. It really isn't. And it was an episode that made you laugh, and it was an episode that made you cry. Or at least it did me, anyway. One of Earthquake's sons occasionally will post old family photos and answer questions on Reddit. Reddit Squared Circle, which is very cool. And one of the things that they didn't get into in the episode was John's association with the WrestleCrap website and how involved he became in the message board community that they had there. I was a big fan of WrestleCrap back in the day. I know it's still up today. I had a lot of laughs on that website. It's run by R.D. Reynolds. Some of the audio that you heard from John in the episode came from old episodes of WrestleCrap Radio. That RD and his co-host Blade Braxton used to host. And they even created a special forum just for John on the WrestleCrap boards where he could post and he could answer questions from all the other crappers. In one message when he got the bad update on his health and how bad things were going, this is what he posted. He said, "I've never been kicked in the balls as hard as I was last Wednesday. Thinking I was licking this thing, I met with my chemo doctor, ready to quake the cancer. Well, I now have a new tumor in my left lung, and two lymph nodes are enlarged in my heart. I go in for chemo tomorrow for a 4-day session. I've been given 13 to 18 months to live. I'm not giving up, and hope to, of course, live longer. But that is what I have been told, and that it is incurable. I don't really know what else to say. It really caught me off guard. I'll try to keep you posted, but no guarantees, folks. Thank you all for your kind support, and may God bless you all." I want to play you a short bit of audio here. This is from one of the last interviews that he ever gave on WrestleCrap Radio. It was November 2005. It was actually the week after Eddie Guerrero passed away. I was listening back to the entire thing the other day, but these parts I pulled together are what stuck out to me the most as a great example of the kind of positive attitude that this man had in the face of what really was a death sentence. And he knew it. And still, he kept a positive attitude about it all.
"I don't know how much time I have left. It could be less than a year. It could be 10 years. We don't know. But until that day comes, I'm blessed in the fact that I have that time to be with my family, to make memories, and prepare everyone for that day. You can't let cancer control your life, you know. Right now, you're young enough, you're healthy enough, you're strong enough to get up every day and do what you want to do with your family. And until that day when you're not strong enough to get out of bed, you can't let it control you. You have to stay positive. You have to keep going. That's the way I felt since the first day I've been diagnosed. I'm too young, too strong, and, you know, it's going to be a big fight between us. Sooner or later, one of us has to win, and whether it's me or the cancer, I'll go into the sunset knowing that I put up a heck of a fight."
I'll leave you with this. He was asked on the message board, as someone battling a terminal illness, how he would like the fans to remember him. And this was his response. "I'd like to be remembered as a pretty good heel that played my role well and put all that I had into the role, even if it sucked. Those of you that have gotten to know me a bit more than the average fan through my postings here hopefully will feel, although I'm faced with a big crisis, that I have been brave and inspirational to some, and hopefully appreciate my warped sense of humor from time to time. Although my illness is serious, I still love a good laugh, which, bless you all, you keep me laughing. I want to be remembered by you crappers as a friend." And that he was. The next episode covers Buff Bagwell, which the producer said is one of the wilder, more jaw-dropping stories they have ever covered on Dark Side of the Ring. So it sounds like it's back to normal next week. Although I will say, I don't know how recent the footage is going to be at the end of next week's episode, but if you go to the DDPY YouTube channel, you see there's a video there of the recent transformation that Buff Bagwell and Scotty Riggs, his former tag team partner in the American Males, have gone through recently. I know Riggs was suicidal. I mean, he was on the verge of not even being with us anymore. And the story of where he was to where he is now, you see the transformation in him. It's unbelievable. I'm telling you, DDP is doing the Lord's work with these men. So I'm happy to see that they're both in a better place, but I can only imagine what's in this episode next week. Let's take some mailbag questions. You can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Dan from Miami, Florida. Just wanted to share with you the thoughts of my girlfriend, who I got into wrestling a little bit in 2016, but only started watching weekly with me since 2021. She appreciates a good match, but is more into the storylines, like the Bloodline, the Judgment Day, Damage Control, and characters. Her current favorites are Tribal Chief Roman, she hated the Big Dog, Punk, Stone Cold, I love it. I just talked about a few weeks ago, I talked about the merchandise charts, Austin's always in the top 10, he was number one a few weeks ago. And here's somebody who is a casual wrestling fan in the year 2024. And Stone Cold is still her favorite. I love it. Heel Rock, Heel Drew, and Rhea Ripley are all her favorites. AEW was too much jumping around in blood for her. Only interest was Punk and MJF. Back to WWE. In her eyes, Cody has daddy issues, and she prefers Rock against Roman. She thinks that Rollins is a clown and has never understood the B championship that he carries. In fact, she says it's worse now because of how he is Cody's friend. After getting rejected by him for a match at WrestleMania, has never beaten him, and now he is Cody's sidekick. Her opinion is a champion being a sidekick is lame, like Roman is being with The Rock. This same souring on a character switch happened in her casual fandom when Becky went from the man to true forced heel, and when Finn went from Prince Balor to Judgment Day sidekick. Back to Seth, it got me thinking that I agree with her. Rollins has been looked at as a sidekick in all of this. What if, and I know you're going to hate this, but what if Rollins and Cody beat the Bloodline on night one, lose to Drew, Seth does, on night two, and then he turns on Cody to help Roman keep the belt? Ultimate heel turn and swerve, but you never know. She says. He says, P.S., you talked about Stone Cold having staying power. My girl has only seen one match of his in countless promos, and she was hooked. Same with CM Punk. There you go, the mind of a female, quote, casual fan. Some people are just timeless and will get over it. Doesn't matter what time period it is. Austin is one of those people. The guy is generational. And so is Punk. So is Punk. You know why, though? Because those guys, especially on the microphone, what those guys were doing, there was a certain authenticity to them that a lot of other people don't have. That I think if you were a casual fan who didn't know much about pro wrestling and you're watching it and you see a character like a Seth Rollins coming out dressed up the way that he is and these other people and R-Truth doing comedy stuff, you look at an Austin or a Punk like, okay, these guys are real. You know what I mean? Like they have an attitude about them. They have a chip on their shoulder. They're cool. They sound real. So I'm not surprised by that, actually, that she would feel that way. As far as the Seth heel turn, you're right. I don't like it. Could I see it happening? Yes. Do I think that Rollins may have ended up going heel anyway if Punk had not gotten hurt? Yes, I think there's a pretty decent chance of it. But boy, I really would not like that idea. I really hope that doesn't happen. Anton from London, longtime listener since 2012. My question this time, though, is about Paul Heyman's induction into the Hall of Fame. You may already have a few of these, but how do you think they are going to skirt around the Lesnar accusations when it comes to Heyman mentioning Brock during his induction speech? I am quite a believer in innocent until proven guilty. However, it seems a lot online, including WWE, which is understandable, have already written Lesnar off as being guilty. Regardless, surely Paul has to mention Lesnar as he was such a big part of his WWE run. It's not a matter of Lesnar being guilty. He didn't commit a crime. He wasn't even named in the lawsuit, but you read between the lines, you know that she was referring to him. What he's accused of is being a creep. He's not accused of he's not guilty of a crime. So it's two totally different things when it comes to him and Vince. But that's why the company is distancing itself from him, and they pulled him from WrestleMania. I would have done the same thing. You can't have him on the card when this is so fresh, and they still don't know where that's going to lead. Now, interestingly, he popped back up on the roster on WWE.com this week. They had taken him off, and all of a sudden, Brock is back on the roster. Here's the thing with Brock and Heyman. Lesnar and Heyman are forever linked together. And the entire reason that Paul came back to the company in the first place was to be with Brock Lesnar. It was such a big part of his own career. So I think he is going to mention him. I don't think he's going to dwell on it. But yes, I think he'll be mentioned. I mean, unless he is explicitly told by the company, he gets one command and they say, you cannot mention Brock. I can't imagine Heyman not bringing up Brock Lesnar in his speech. I mean, how do you do that? So yeah, he'll mention him. I just don't think he'll dwell on him. It's not going to be a huge part of his speech. But you got to mention him. You can't not mention him. Noel from the Bronx. After watching Chris Van Vliet's interview with John Cena and talking about how John almost turned heel back in 2012, it got me thinking, we all know Cena doesn't have a lot of years left in him these days. So what if during that time, John Cena does get a heel turn? I know it's a dead idea at this point, but hear me out. It doesn't need to be a permanent turn. It could be brief, like Shawn Michaels back in 2005 when he went against Hulk Hogan. The scenario goes like this. After Cody Rhodes beats Roman Reigns and becomes champion, Cody celebrates the Raw after WrestleMania. He gets attacked by Solo Sikoa and Jimmy Uso, and John Cena makes a surprise return. A tag team match for the main event is set. Cody and Cena beat Jimmy and Solo. Everyone's having a good time, and boom! John hits Cody with an attitude adjustment and looks at Cody's championship. The explanation can be that despite John talking about how his career is ending, he doesn't want it to end just yet, not until he gets championship number 17, and he is willing to do whatever it takes to get it. The match between John and Cody can happen at Backlash, and then John goes back to being a babyface after Cody beats him and makes Cena realize the error of his ways. What are your thoughts on this idea? So what you're proposing here is that Cody look like an idiot the way that he did after WrestleMania last year. Remember, there was going to be a tag team match last year. Cody and Brock were going to be partners, and then Brock turned on him and left him laying. So you're effectively proposing the same thing 2 years in a row, which I wouldn't do that. Look, I don't see the point if it's only for a month and he probably won't even be available to be on television every week to make it worth doing. Even The Rock right now is actually surprisingly appearing on television consistently. I don't think you're going to get John Cena for a consistent run. The only reason he had time to do that two-month run that he did in the fall is because of the strike. Strike's over now. You know, now they're back to work. He's a busy guy. If he can't fully commit to it, I don't see the point in doing it. And I think that ship sailed with Cena a long time ago anyway. I think a heel turn for him in 2012, after that WrestleMania in Miami, would have been perfect. But Vince McMahon got cold feet because Cena was his golden boy, and he was too afraid to give up all that merch money. Now you're looking at a John Cena who has granted more make-a-wishes than anyone in the history of the organization. And you don't even have him full-time. And you're going to turn him heel? Are you going to turn him heel for a match of Backlash? I sound like Joey Styles now. Backlash? No. No. It's a clever idea, but I can't get behind that. I can't get behind it, and I can't see it happening. Casey the truck driver. With Tony Khan going so over the top with Sting, I was curious, where do you rank Sting? Is he in the 10 to 15 range of all time? I think that that's fair. I think he's top 20 for me. He's not in my top 10. My top 10, and I was thinking about this, and I've gotten a lot of questions about this. There's been a lot of talk about Sting and, you know, where he ranks in history. I mentioned he's not on a lot of people's Mount Rushmores when you ask them. He just sort of falls just below that threshold for a lot of people. My top 10, it's not ranked. You got Hogan in there. You got to have Hogan in there. Randy Savage is in there for me. I just thought Savage was just the complete package. When I think of a pro wrestler, I think of Randy Savage, Steve Austin, The Rock, Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, Ric Flair. I put Kurt Angle on there. I put Brock Lesnar on there. You can tell I grew up a WWE fan, by the way. Hogan and Savage and Bret and Shawn and Austin and Rock. I feel like if you grew up in the Carolinas, you were watching Jim Crockett, you were watching the NWA, you'd have Flair, you'd probably have Steamboat, you'd have Dusty, like maybe Vader. Like everyone's list is going to look different. But I would have Kurt, I would have Brock. What is that, 9? I would probably have Undertaker on there. Maybe I'd stick him in my top 10. Okada may end up in there one day. I didn't grow up watching Okada. He's younger than me. And I can't say that I have fond memories of these great Okada promos, you know, like I do Savage and Flair and guys like that, where, again, it was the whole package. It wasn't just their matches. It was their character. It was their promos. It was their charisma, the whole overall presentation. But Okada, he's just so damn good, so damn early in his career. By the time he turned 30, he had already had so many epic matches. So I may slot him in there before all is said and done. Bryan Danielson, I mean, there's so many of them. But I think Sting would fall somewhere in that 10 to 20 range. Robbie in Hartford, Connecticut. It's WrestleMania season, and I wanted to ask you about WrestleMania 8. I've heard you say before that it's one of your favorite manias, but it doesn't get a lot of love when you see lists of the greatest manias. Which match is your favorite from the show, and why? It doesn't get a lot of love as one of the best WrestleManias because it wasn't. It's a personal favorite of mine, though. You know, business was not great at the time. Business was not exactly booming for them in 1992. It wasn't booming for WCW either, and yet some of my favorite WCW matches came from that 92-93 period. But I loved the Randy Savage-Ric Flair match. I loved the post-match mayhem that ensued when Flair kissed Elizabeth and Savage lost his mind. I loved the Ultimate Warrior run-in at the end of the show, even though the Hogan match with Sid sucked. The Warrior run-in was great. Everybody just lost their minds. Even Undertaker against Jake the Snake, I liked it. But the best match on the show, and one of the greatest matches in WrestleMania history, is Bret Hart against Rowdy Roddy Piper. Babyface against babyface. Watching Piper slip back a little bit to his heel roots in different points of the match. And putting Bret over in a way that he did very few people. Bret blading, right? The blood added to the match. Even when they weren't supposed to back then, and he got away with it. He got away with it because he convinced Vince McMahon that it was hard way, even though it wasn't. Flair bled on the same show, and he got in trouble for it because it's Ric Flair, so of course it wasn't by accident, everybody knew that. But the other thing about that WrestleMania that a lot of people don't think about, and I didn't at the time either because I was too young to really realize it, but it marked a changing of the guard in WWE. Not with the Warrior coming back or Savage and Flair being on top, but you had the Undertaker decisively beating Jake the Snake and sending him out of the company. Taker had just turned babyface. He cemented himself with that win as one of the top babyfaces in the company. You know, it was out with the old guard, in with the new. Bret beating Piper, same thing. Out with the old guard, in with the new. That was the biggest win of Bret's career up to that point. And even in the opening match, Shawn Michaels going over on Tito Santana. Out with the old, in with the new. Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart, and The Undertaker. Three of the top names of the new generation era that followed, all going over on the old names. It was a necessary step that had to be taken. Yandy from South Africa. Do you know of any notable matches between Shawn Michaels and X-Pac? I know other Click members faced each other in various combinations, but I have never heard of any match between Shawn and the 1-2-3 Kid, and in their prime, those two together could have produced a banger. I wouldn't call them notable, but they did wrestle a few times in singles matches. They had a match in 93, and he would have been the 1-2-3. Well, he was the 1-2-3 Kid for all their matches. As X-Pac, no, but as the 1-2-3 Kid, yes. They had a couple more times in, I want to say, 96, where they wrestled. I know some of those matches were on Raw. I don't remember any of them, so I can't vouch for their quality, but I can't imagine them being anything less than good. And Mike in Lakeland, Florida. Buy or sell. Sting is not available. Who do you think would have made for the better opponent for a high-profile match with The Undertaker? Abyss or PCO? I actually think both of those matches would have been pretty damn good. I'm going to go Abyss on that, and we almost had it. We almost had that match in 2006, I want to say. I think 2006. Abyss was going to come in, and then he got cold feet. And he wanted to stay with TNA, so we never got it. But I think Undertaker and Abyss, I would buy on that, and I would sell on the PCO match. I want to hear from you, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name, and I will try my best to respond or get you on the show. I do read everything you guys send me. I just don't always have a chance to include it in the mailbag. But I'm going to try to get you in next week, so go ahead and do that. Follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. Check out Solomonster Sounds Off on YouTube as we climb towards 80,000 subscribers. Only you can get me there. I'll be live again on Monday night after Raw. We got a big episode of Dynamite coming up on Wednesday. Big business, big debut coming. So I'll be live then and again after SmackDown on Friday. And then back here with you again next Sunday for episode 853 of the podcast as we march towards WrestleMania. And hopefully very soon I'll be able to announce something that I'm working on that hopefully will come to fruition. So we'll see how that goes. But I will see you next time. Until then, be well, stay safe, and come on back here for more Sound Off next Sunday, 8:53. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Kareem points out, we celebrated the fact that we just had our first full week, all bells and Be the Booker. But we have a pay-per-view. I may have celebrated a little too soon. The Green Pianist says, Kareem is the kid in class that reminds the teacher about homework.
Teacher, you forgot to give us homework. We need homework to have one more Be the Booker. Don't forget, one more teacher.
I say tomorrow we hang Kareem upside down and shake him so his lunch money falls out of his pocket. And we'll throw him in his locker and we'll lock him in there. How about that?
The Solomonster Sounds Off, each week bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster. Solomonster Sounds Off.